And
there we go.
Let's begin. Good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're enjoying your virtual and non-virtual lunch. And it's a pleasure to learn together. Once again, thank you so much, Rabbi Zisuk, for this opportunity. And what we're going to learn today, Yirtzeh Hashem, is going to be a serious look at a perplexing scene in our parsha, one that doesn't get a lot of time when we're learning it. You know, oftentimes the stories of Bereishis we learn as we're kids growing up. And this is the kind of story that you tend to not tell with little kids. And that's the story of Dina getting we'll say brought into Shechem. She's seduced by Shechem, and eventually the slaughter of the entire city by the brothers Levi and Shimon. A lot of our insights will be based off of my Rebbe, Rav Avigdor Nebenzahl, Chief Rabbi of the Old City of Yerushalayim, in his Sefer Yerushalayim at Moadeha. I got this last year, and the Sefer is so beautiful and so sweet, and such a schus to be able to learn it together with you. Thank you so very, very much for joining me today. And one moment. Okay. And so from time to time, I'll share my screen if we really need to look at the psukim inside. But overall, in general, I'll mention the sources outside, and feel free to open up a chumash and look inside, although I think we're familiar enough with this narrative. Because as we're well aware, Dina goes out, and she's found by Shechem. He seduces her. He brings her into the city. And then he propositions the Jewish people. He propositions Yaakov and his children, and says, "You know, can I marry your daughter? Can I become part of the Shvatim, if you will?" And the sons and Yaakov, they end up talking to Shechem and Hamor, his father. And you always have to question, you know, if someone's named Hamor, the name donkey, then who is his kind of personality? But the deal is struck that they're allowed to marry Dina. Dina can join their kingdom if everyone in Shechem gets a bris milah. And on the third day, as we know, Rashi tells us, Chazal tell us that the third day, the most painful part of the bris milah, where everyone is really inundated and unable to operate, everyone's stuck at home, Shimon and Levi make their way into the city and kill everyone. And then the conversation takes place between Shimon and Levi and Yaakov Avinu. And Yaakov starts yelling at them, which is not terribly surprising. And he tells us, this is in Bereishis, Perek Lamed Dalet, Psukim Lamed to Lamed Aleph, Yaakov tells his sons, "Achartem osi, you have brought trouble to me. Now the people living around me are not going to like me." And gives a couple examples. And I am few in number. And they're going to gather around me. And they're going to attack me. They're going to destroy me and my house. Little did Yaakov Avinu maybe realize that this was a prophecy that would befall the Jewish people in the future, that Eretz Yisrael today, the state of Israel today, is surrounded by people who don't exactly like us so much, who on occasion have tried to attack us, and even if we did nothing or anything, this seems to be consistent throughout all of history, that our neighbors are not always going to like us, and that's just the nature of being part of Bnei Israel in Eretz Yisrael. But nonetheless, Yaakov Avinu yells at his children and says, "How could you do this to me?" And what's their response? Vayomru, in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, "Shall we allow our sister to become a harlot?" Which is a perfectly nice answer. But I can imagine that Yaakov Avinu would have a response to that. He could say a few different things, and yet the psukim are silent. We don't have a response from Yaakov Avinu. Why doesn't Yaakov respond? What's going on? What happens in this story? If we were to, and this is an important thing to do whenever we're looking at the narratives, particularly in Sefer Bereishis, but in general, the narratives in Tanakh, what would the screenplay look like? Because it's very easy to read psukim, but are we really imagining the conversation? You know, I had a conversation with one of our students. This is in my afternoon role, but it's still, I think, a chinuch role overall. I had a conversation with one of my students this week about the importance of reading. And that when we read, scientists say that we create images in our mind, as opposed to just watching TV. You know, what's the difference between reading of Mice and Men versus watching the movie? On the one hand, you get some more details, and you have to develop your language a little bit. But more than that, when you read anything, instead of just consuming it passively from watching a movie, you have to create the picture in your mind, and developing that muscle in your head is very good for thinking, very good for intelligence development. And so when we're looking at these psukim, what would that screenplay look like? What would that movie, if you will, look like? What picture are we drawing in our minds of that conversation between Yaakov and Shimon and Levi? What are the intonations? What are the emphases in their words? And what happens next? This conversation ends, and then it's almost like, you know, the person who gets the last word in the argument, they win. Do Shimon and Levi, quote-unquote, win this argument because they have nothing else to say? Now, we're familiar on more than one occasion where Yaakov Avinu, he holds on to things. He doesn't say everything right off the bat. Because we know a little bit later on, In next week's parsha, Yosef is prophesizing that he's going to lead all his brothers. His brothers don't seem to appreciate that very much. And Yaakov Avinu sees all this happening, doesn't really say much to Yosef, but the pasuk in Lamed Zayin, Yud Aleph, tells us, Va'aviv shamar sadavar, Yaakov Avinu guarded this, he remembered this was going to happen. So Yaakov Avinu clearly will sometimes choose to not say anything, even though he has much to share. And we see this most acutely at the end of Yaakov's life, in Parshas Vayechi, Perek Mem Tes, Pasukim Hey through Zion, where he says, Shimon Levi, your Achim, your brothers, and that's beautiful. However, Bistom Al Tavod Nafshi Behakalam Al Tachid Kavodi, Ki Ba'apam Harguish Uvotsonam Ikrushor. You guys, in your anger, in your brotherliness, you murdered people. You took down the city of Shechem, and he yells at them. And so clearly Yaakov is not happy about what's going on in this interaction. He's not happy about what's going on in Parshas Vayishlach about killing people of Shechem. And yet he waits all the way until Vayechi to yell at them. So what's happening here? And we're going to look at three options. Options number one and two are based on the Midrashim and based off of the various Rishonim. And option number three will be inspired and informed by Rav Nevin Sashlita. We'll take a look at option number one, and that's really from the Ralbag. And this one maybe is the one that you're thinking in your mind. Why does Yaakov Avinu not say anything in this interaction? Is it Vayomru HaKazonaya says HaKosenu, and Yaakov is silent because he agrees with Shimon Levi? No, of course not, Chalila. Yaakov Avinu does not agree with his sons. Yaakov Avinu thinks what they did was wrong. However, he can see so clearly that they're yelling, HaKazonaya says HaKosenu, that they should make our sister into a harlot. They're riled up, they're on fire, and there's so much passion and excitement right now towards something that's not so good, that now is not the moment, now is not the time to point out their flaws, to point out what they did wrong. And the Ralbag says that only when it comes to the Birkos Yaakov, only at the end of Yaakov's life, when this is a scene, this is an episode that is long past, can he give them proper mussar. It's ironic, perhaps, although it fits beautifully here, that if you learn the Maharal's Ner Mitzvah, the Maharal's Sefer, all about Hanukkah, at the end, he talks about this mitzvah of Tokacha. He talks about how the need to give rebuke is necessary and important, however, only if it will be heard. Only if the person who's hearing you give them rebuke is actually going to listen. Because all of us, each and every one of us, has an obligation to rebuke our friends, to rebuke our families. However, it's very hard to do so. It's hard to do it from our perspective, and it's hard to do it on their side to hear it. And if it's happening in the moment, that might not actually be the most effective form of rebuke. And so one has to be very, very careful. And Yaakov Avinu perhaps gives us a sterling example of what proper rebuke should look like. Of in the heat of the moment, when the person can't hear what you're going to say, don't say a word. But wait until everything is calm. Wait until the scene is over. Wait until we've gotten past it. And now you can share words of wisdom. Now you can share what's necessary and important feedback with your friend, with your family member, so they can hear, they can get better. And so our first answer, perhaps very simply, maybe we'll call it a layup, is that Yaakov Avinu, of course, did not agree with Shimon Levi. Shimon Levi, without question, did not win, even though Yaakov Avinu was silent. Yaakov Avinu was silent because he was planning on giving the Mussar at the end of his life, later on, because they could not hear the Mussar right now. That's answer number one. Answer number two is perhaps more surprising. I find it intriguing, but a little bit hard to swallow. And that comes from the Medrash Lekach Tov. And the Medrash Lekach Tov, I'm going to share my screen just so that you can see it and trust that it's really happening. Otherwise, you might not believe me, and I would totally appreciate that. I totally understand. But I'm sharing my screen now. And we say, Yaakov is speechless. And in the Medrash Lekach Tov in our Parsha, it says, Vayamru hakizona, heishivuhu teshuva nitzeches. They were right. Shimon and Levi won the argument. They were right. Yaakov Avinu was speechless because he had nothing to say. He's like, Taka, that's a good point. I didn't think about it like that. How inappropriate is it for them to take Dina in? Lalandeka Shanusa Haisa, she was raped. And we suggested that she was just seduced. We suggested that Shechem just brought her in. But if she was mamish raped, if he did something that was awful and terrible, that has long-lasting ramifications on a person's psychological condition for years and years and years to come, that's an awful, terrible thing to do. And they said, we can't stand for it. That's not something you do to a Bas Yaakov. And the Malbim sort of alludes to this also in our parak. He says, Vayamru hashivu shebehefech. No, they're saying just the opposite. Avashah anachnu mesem ispar. We're small in number. V'gerim baretz, and we're living in this land. V'yishchilu lifrotz banu b'mashe lachu es achosinu kazona. And they're testing the waters that the people of Shechem are seeing. Yeah, you know, these people of Yaakov and his children, they're small. And I wonder, can we mess with them? Can we have our way with them? Can we do something to them? And what are they going to do to respond? And Shemur and Levi are saying, this precisely is the moment that we have to do something. This precisely right now is what we need to be doing in order to prevent this from happening again. Because they're testing us out and seeing how are we going to react if they take our sister. And so they say in the bold, Im Nakarish, if we stay silent now, Yasu Banu Kiratsonim, they're going to do whatever they want with us. Vitzarik Laharos Lahem, Ki Yesh Elia Denu, Binakem Hanogeya Banu Lara. We have the power, we have the ability to take revenge, to rise up, to stop them. I'll unshare my screen now. The reason Yaakov Avinu is speechless, the reason Yaakov Avinu is silent, is not because he's planning on giving them Musar later on, it's because they were totally right. Hakizonayas Yases Hakosenu. We can't allow this to happen. This is totally inappropriate. If they mess with us now and we don't do anything, they're going to continue over and over and over again. We got to establish ourselves right now at the get-go from the very, very beginning. And so in those quick minutes, we really saw two answers. And on the one hand, Yaakov's planning giving them a rebuke. On the other hand, maybe Yaakov doesn't give them the rebuke at this moment because they were to some extent right. Even if we were to assume, like the Medrash, like the Malbim says, that they were right, still, the way they did it was inappropriate. The way that they did it should not have happened, and that's why Yaakov Avinu yells at them and says, in your anger, you attacked. And still, there's a musar to give. There's a musar to share. There's a lesson and a way to do it. Oftentimes in life, we'll have people who end up doing the right thing, but either for the wrong reasons or they did it in the wrong way. Feedback is so imminently important, and yet the way you give feedback, the way you share what's going on with someone needs to be thought out. And you might be able to give feedback in the right way, and it'll be heard, or feedback in the wrong way, and it will not be heard. And so you see that in Yaakov in the first example, and maybe so too in the second example. In the second example, Yaakov wanted the Shimon Levi to be diplomatic about it and say, this is not how we operate. This is not appropriate to treat our family. One moment, I want to make sure that my connection is good. I'm connected, wonderful. I'm just getting a little bit yelled at. Okay, we're good. Those are our two options. Those are our two examples. And now I want to share with you a third one that I find so compelling, so interesting. And this is from Nevinsal, again, in his Sefer Yushalayim v'Moadeha on Hanukkah. And just again, let's appreciate what's going on with Shimon and Levi. I'm going to share my screen once again. Shimon and Levi go into Shechem, and they're certain that they're going to win. They're certain that this is the right thing to do. They didn't think they were doing anything wrong. They didn't think that they were sneaking behind Yaakov Avinu's back. They thought that this is exactly what Abba wants us to do. They were convinced. Because the Pasuk, a few Pasukim earlier, tells us what's going on, that they're going in. This is the Pasuk Chaf Hei. Vayihi bayom ha-shlishi, b'yos ko'avim. When people of Shechem were in so much pain, vayikhu shnei b'nei Yaakov, Shimon v'Levi, achei Dinah. And the siblings of Dinah, Yaakov's sons, Shimon and Levi, they go in with swords, ishkarbo, vayavo el ha'ir, and they go into the city. What's that next adjective? How do they go into the city? They don't just go into the city secretly. They don't go in surreptitiously. They don't go in the dead of night. They go into the city in blue, betach. They go in with certainty. And we say in Eretz Yisrael, if you're living in Israel and you have insurance, we say you have bitachon, that you have insurance, that you know this is going to work out. You know that you're going to be okay. That they're going to the city, betach, vayagu kol zakar, and they kill everyone. Rashi tells us, what does it mean that they go in betach, they go in with certainty? Why are they so certain? Maybe because shayu kovim, they're certain that they're going to win, they're certain they're going to be okay, because everyone else is really a sitting duck, everyone else is in pain. But maybe we would say, bituchim hayu al kokol shel zakin. The Midrashim tell us that they are batuach, they trust in their father. They think that they are emissaries, that they are messengers of Yaakov Avinu, that what they're doing is totally 100% in the right. They're about to kill a whole city, and they think that what they're doing is right? How could they think that? And so once again, we see this line that we've referenced already twice. They say in this argument, Yaakov Avinu tells them, you shouldn't have done that, that was inappropriate, that was a bad thing to do. And they respond, yelling at Yaakov Avinu. This screenplay would have them head to head, eyes locked into each other, maybe 6 inches away. And Shimon and Levi are yelling at their father, at Yaakov Avinu. And they say, Vayomru, Hakizona Yases Akosenu? Should we allow our sister to be treated as a harlot? Says Rav Nevinsal, the key word here is Akosenu. should our sister be treated like a harlot? Because if we were really thought about it, they had a halakhic basis for doing this. Rambam tells us that a non-Jew is responsible to uphold the Shiva mitzvah, but if they don't follow them, then they could be liable. And this, if Dina was in fact raped, this is a gross violation of Shiva mitzvah b'nei noach. According to the Rambam, according to many Mepharshim, they were totally capable on a halakhic level to kill out the people of Shechem. However, Yaakov Avinu is yelling at them because of what motivated them, because of what brought them to this action. Vayomru hakezona yaseh es acho seinu. Should our sister be treated like a harlot? And then as we continue the screenplay, Yaakov Avinu doesn't say a word. He doesn't say a word, not because he's speechless, not because he doesn't know what to say, not because he's planning on saying something later on, but because as soon as Levi and Shimon say the words, Achoseinu, as soon as they say, should our sister be treated like a harlot, they stop. They're the ones who are silent. Because they realize the flaw in their actions. They realize the mistake that they made. They realize that the reason they killed the people of Shechem was not for the honor of Yaakov's house. It was not because they were trying to protect anyone. They did it for themselves, for their own kavod. Because me, Shimon and Levi, I'm not willing to let someone do that to my sister. And so Yaakov Avinu doesn't need to say a word. Yaakov Avinu just smiles knowingly and says, okay, they got it. Atzur Nevin tells us on page Sadi Vav and Sadi Zayin in his Sefer, V'ulai lachein mistayim havikuach b'torah b'sheila Shimon v'Levi. Maybe that's why the conversation between Shimon and Levi ends, Hakezonai yaseh akoseinu. Maybe that's the reason why that's the last line. Ki berega shepaltu samila akoseinu. As soon as they said akoseinu, hevinu ba'atzvam shem makshavasam lo chaysa chaseres pinias lechalutin. They weren't acting appropriately. They weren't acting righteously. V'shuv lo hutzrak Yaakov lidvakeach itam. He didn't have to talk to them anymore. He was done. That was enough. That was complete. They figured out what they did wrong. They understood what they did wrong. And there was nothing else needed to be shared. So with that appreciation, that understanding in mind, Rav Nevinsel takes that lesson between Shimon and Levi acting what seemingly is lishma, but not really lishma, seemingly doing something that is for the sake of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, but there's something missing, there's something lacking. It's a little bit less about the kavod shemayim, a little bit more about the kavod of ani, the kavod ani, the kavod of myself, more than the kavod of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And he contrasts this actions of Shimon and Levi with one of Levi's descendants generations later, with the descendants of Levi during the Zman of Chanukah, because Chanukah is a time very much about doing things lishma, as we'll see, on a halakhic level even. But Chanukah, even the storyline, is about being lishma. Let's take a look at something that Rav Nevinsel alludes to as well. He talks about it, but we're going to look at how Rabbi Yosef B. Soloveitchik explains it to us in his book about Chanukah, Days of Deliverance, page 131, 132. I'm going to share my screen again and read this inside. Ordinarily, I'd rather not read something that's four paragraphs long, but as Rabbi Menachem Penner points out, it's near impossible to find better words to use than what Rabbi Soloveitchik used. If Rabbi Soloveitchik opted to use these words, this was the most accurate way of expressing the idea. So let's take a look. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that the storyline, that the uprising of the Hasmoneans was specifically for Lashem Shemayim purposes. He says, actually, there's a general misconception about the motivation for the Hasmonean uprising. The revolt of Matisyahu and the high priest and his sons was not a response to political pressure. From the time of Ezra until that of Matisyahu, the kingdom of Israel had never been politically independent. In the beginning, it was under the influence of Persia and then of Egypt. Later, it was part of Alexander the Great's empire, and after his death, it came under Syrian Greek sovereignty. If the only issue had been political sovereignty, the revolt would never have broken out. The Jews would have continued to accept their suffering, quote-unquote, with love, and would have waited for the eventual complete redemption. The conflict with the Greeks was a different matter entirely. The Greeks hated the Jews' spiritual essence, their worldview, their peculiarity, their being different. In short, the Greeks hated their Torah. The motive for their hatred was Haman's complaint, that they're different than us. They depart from ways of our own and of our kingdom. So the Greeks were not satisfied with political pressure. They began to meddle with the intimate realm of human life. Jumping to our next paragraph. It was this persecution of religion that distressed the Hasmonaim and fanned the flames of battle. As our sages put it well, what is the reason for Chanukah? My Chanukah. When the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oil that was there. That's what the Gemara in Shabbos tells us. The reason for the Great Revolt was the Greeks entering the sanctuary, the Jewish temple, and defiling all the oil, bringing it into their pagan cult and weakening the holiness of Israel through its Sabbath, through its laws of modesty and family purity. The war broke out because of the temple, not because of political freedom. And this same history is recounted in the Alanisim prayer, when the evil kingdom of Greece rose up against your people Israel to make them forget your Torah and to force them to transgress the statutes of your will. We say explicitly in Alanisim, the issue was not political pressure. The issue was that of spiritual pressure. Because so much of Hanukkah is about expressing the Lishma, expressing the political goals, the political ideal, and the spiritual goals that we're working toward, about making sure that what we're doing is Lishma, making sure that what we're doing is what a Kodesh Baruch Hu really wants. To not get so caught up in the chitzonis, in the externalities, that we end up doing the wrong thing. And we'll see this play out lahalacha. Because Rav Nachmanson asked a question, a fascinating question, informed both by the Pnei Yehoshua and Tshuvas, Pnei Yehoshua on this part of the Gemara, and a Tshuva of the Chacham Tzvi. The menorah was not the only thing that was defiled. The oil, was not the only thing that was defiled, but the menorah was as well. In order for the Maccabees to create this Hanukkah miracle that we're so familiar with, they had to take wooden poles and iron sticks and turn them into a menorah. The menorah that they used in our story was not a beautiful menorah. It wasn't a special menorah. It was a very, very makeshift, very, very rudimentary menorah. And so while the oil is the focus of the miracle, maybe it didn't have to be. Why did the oil have to be the thing that was saved? Maybe the menorah should have been saved instead. Because we know that they took all of the beautiful, all of the kelim outside out of the base of Medesh, and yet Rav Nachmanson wonders, maybe there's a lesson here. Maybe there's something for us to take away from the fact that the menorah was not saved and only the oil was saved. Because let's take a look at the Rambam in Hilchos Beis HaBechira. These are the laws of the Beis HaMikdash. Because the first two laws in the third parak talk to us about the menorah and says, "Bamed dvarim amurim b'she'asahu zahav." What does it look like when the menorah is made of gold? That's really when it's halachachila. We want the menorah to be made of gold. Aval, but sharmini matakos, other kinds of metal, ain't osim b'gavim v'kaftorim uprachim. You don't make all of the intricate cups and goblets that really beautify the menorah, that make the menorah mahadrim and a mahadrim, if you will, make them so beautiful. V'chei menorah ba'zav tiyah kula kikar im nereseh v'tiyah kula mekusha min hashasos. Ideally, a menorah is going to be something that's made from one block. It's made from just gold. Ironically, the menorah that the Machon HaMikdash made is not made from one block because it was too hard to build, and so they have some metal in there to hold up the rods, which halakhically is okay, but it's not lechachila. And so even though it's all kosher, it's not ideal. It's not really what we want. The menorah that the Chashmonaim used was not lechachila. And yet the oil was lechachila. The oil was beautiful and perfect. And the Gemara in Mordezarat on Mem Gimel Amud Aleph tells us that they used shvudim shel barzel. They used spits of iron and wood. And only later on, once they made a little bit more money, when I saw him shall cast it, then they turned it into a silver menorah, chazurvat v'ishiru, then they got even more rich, and I saw him shall zav, then they made it out of gold. And now we're going to unshare our screen. Because Rav Nachmanson is looking at this and saying, it's kind of funny that we have a miracle with oil. Why not have a miracle with the menorah? Why not have a miracle that's so clear and overt? If they had used impure oil, would anyone have known about it? Would the people who hear about this story, the drawings of Hanukkah, have been so much more impressive with a beautiful menorah, a menorah that had kafter of farach on it, as opposed to an ugly menorah, a makeshift menorah, a non-ideal menorah, but a menorah that had pure oil. The pure oil was effectively private. It was secret. No one else knew about it. No one knew. Only through the lens of Torah and mitzvos could you appreciate that this menorah, that this oil was pure. So Nachmanson wonders, why wasn't the menorah saved? Why was the oil saved instead? And he says, this perhaps is exactly the same point that we learned with Shimon and Levi. Because Shimon and Levi, they were doing the right thing. They were trying their best. However, the motivation, the internality of what they were doing, that's what was askew. That's what didn't go right. Hakizonaya says Hakosenu, that's what threw them off. That they were doing it for the wrong reasons. Their internals were bad. If the menorah was beautiful, if the menorah had the kafter aferach, externally, it would have looked great, and it would have been fine. However, when it comes to the oil, there's no way to differentiate between the inside and the outside. You've got to do it yourself. You have to make sure, you have to know, this is pure oil, not impure oil. And maybe the miracle of Hanukkah takes place with oil, specifically because nobody else would know. Because no one else could figure out what's going on internally. Only we know what's internally motivating us. And part of the lesson of Hanukkah is what's motivating us. What's motivating us? What's pushing us to do what we're trying to do? Maybe we're doing mitzvahs, but why are we doing those mitzvahs? Maybe we're going to learning, but why are we going to learning? This is such a beautiful example of pure intentions, of Shem and Zayit Zach, of learning Torah. This is virtual gourmet Torah with no gourmet happening. This is just virtual Torah. And so even though we're not eating shallots, still we're coming to learn. We've got people coming together in the middle of the day because they just want to learn Torah. That is so beautiful. That is the pure olive oil that we're celebrating on Hanukkah. And at this time when there's so many ways that we can be external, Hanukkah is asking us to look internally. That in a time of darkness, when we light a candle, that candle is supposed to be lit so that we can see the beauty of our actions, the beauty of what's going on inside. That our external motivations shouldn't be there. That what it looks like on the outside, what a beautiful menorah might look like, that's not really the goal. Really the goal is about what's going on in here. And so today we looked at three different understandings, three different examples of how we might look at this Yaakov and Shimon and Levi story. And on the one hand, Yaakov's waiting to give tochacha until the very, very end of his life when they've come down. On another hand, Yaakov Avinu agrees with them, which is why he doesn't yell at them. But perhaps most interestingly, Yaakov Avinu doesn't yell at them because they understood themselves that their motivation was corrupt. And based on that corrupt motivation, they realize they messed up. Because Hanukkah is all about sincere motivation, about wanting to do things the right way, the spiritual way. And whether that's starting the revolt by the Chashmonaim, or it's the way that we light the menorah, but using the most pure olive oil that no one else can see because it's purely motivated, the internals are pure, versus the externals of the menorah. And so even though halakhically, maybe we could suggest that the menorah could have been the one that's fixed, after all, we say Tumah Hutra B'Tzibor, and it would have made more sense, if you will, for the menorah to be the one that was perfect and wonderful and had the Kaftar Referach and the impure oil. But says Rav Nevin Sal, that's not the point of Hanukkah. The point of Hanukkah is to be purely internally motivated, and so that's the miracle that we experience. It's been a pleasure learning together. Thank you so, so very much. And now I've got afternoon Seder. Have a great day.
Shabbat, Rabbi Zucker. Thank you so much, Rabbi Zucker. Tiskel and Mitzvahs.